Welcome back to Integrating New Advances into the Care of Patients with Cancer, a multi-tumor symposium in partnership with the American Oncology Network. I think this is our final module for the day, so thanks for hanging in there with us. We're going to be discussing gastroesophageal cancers. We're blessed to have Dr. Manish Shah here with us today as our faculty. Dr. Shah is professor of medicine at Cornell in New York. These are disclosures. Again, we'll lay some background with patient populations within the American Oncology Network. These are numbers of esophageal cancer and gastric cancer patients throughout the network. We'll look at drug utilization patterns, looking at Nevo and Pembro utilization. It looks to be sort of a 2-to-1 Nevo versus Pembro in this space. And then also looking at the plot data and the utilization patterns that we've seen. TDXD for those that are HER2 positive, and zolbetuximab, though I know of a patient that was treated since this data was collected. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to you, Dr. Shah.
Great, thank you. And I know I am between, I'm standing between the sun, so I will be quick. But it's great to be here, and thanks for sticking around. So there's been a lot of changes in upper GI cancers, and let me start with biomarkers. I think that one of the key things is that this is now a crowded field. It almost feels like lung cancer, where we have, we've had HER2 for a while, but now we have PD-L1, we have MSI-high, we have Claudin. There was recently data on FGFR2. Unfortunately, that didn't meet its endpoint, so it's, that doesn't mean that other drugs won't be in that space. It is a good target. So there are a lot of biomarkers. And this is the pie chart that kind of highlights them and the prevalence of the biomarkers. I don't like this image, in part because it suggests that the biomarkers are mutually exclusive. If you're PD-L1 positive, you could also be Claudin positive. So another way to look at it is this way. It's much more complicated. So there is overlap between HER2 and PD-L1. There's a lot of overlap. There is some overlap between Claudin and PD-L1, but maybe less overlap there. MSI high is almost all PD-L1 positive. So you really need to think of the co-mutations and the complexity of the targets. They don't neatly fit into a pie. So that's one thing to keep in mind. And let me start off with immunotherapy. That's, I think, the biggest change in how we manage gastroesophageal cancers in the last decade or so. And so these are three key studies that highlight the role of immunotherapy in gastroesophageal junction cancers. And they actually involve three different drugs. Nivolumab, that's CheckMate 649, and that was a large study with FOLFOX plus or minus nivolumab. And it showed for the first time that adding immunotherapy was beneficial. KEYNOTE-859 was the Merck study that looked at chemo plus or minus Pembro, and it had a similar benefit. And then RATIONALE 305 study, that was tislelizumab, which is the latest immunotherapy that got approved for upper GI cancers. So now the FDA has approved all three of these drugs in practice with chemotherapy in the first-line setting for PD-L1 positive patients. So we'll have to update the survey and add tislelizumab as another option for your practice. So this is the CheckMate 649 study. On the left is the intention to treat population of CPS5 and higher, and that's where most of the benefit is. And then on the right is all randomized studies. And what you can see is that the hazard ratio creeps up from 0.7 to 0.8. What it means is that the hazard ratio for lower than 5 is closer to 0.9. That's how the math works there. So really, we have an idea that checkpoint inhibition, immunotherapy, works much better if you're expressing PD-L1. KEYNOTE-859, similar data. On the left is the overall survival. On the right is progression-free survival. And then here is the RATIONALE 305 study with tislelizumab. And you can see similar hazard ratio, 0.74, very significant p-value. And I think what excites people about immunotherapy, there is a marginal benefit. The response rate's a little bit higher. But look at the tail on the curve. The tail on the curve is at 2 years, 24 months, or 2.5 years, 30 months. You know, it would be unheard of to think of chemotherapy alone giving you such a long survival. 30% of people are alive at 2.5 or 3 years. That's really unusual for gastroesophageal junction cancer. So we are changing the landscape and the natural history of this disease. Because tislelizumab was done with something called the TAP score, TAP, which is tumor area positivity, the FDA brought all these companies together in a ODAC meeting. This is the Oncology Drug Advisory Committee meeting last fall. And they wanted to harmonize. They wanted to bring together and say, look, we can't have all these different systems. We need to have a biomarker for this class of drugs. And they pulled the data together, and they see that, you know, if your CPS is positive, your hazard ratio is very good at 0.8. So there's a 20% improvement in survival. But if your CPS is negative, less than 1, I should say, your hazard ratio is 0.85, 0.92. It really doesn't work that well. So the FDA, based on this ODAC meeting, essentially has said that you have to express PD-L1 to receive a checkpoint inhibitor. And that's true for nivolumab, pembrolizumab, and tislelizumab. Now, the drugs are given at slightly different intervals. Nivolumab is given every 2 weeks. Pembrolizumab is given every 3 weeks. They both have long-acting doses, so nivolumab could be given either 2 or 4 weeks, pembro either 3 or 6 weeks, and tislelizumab is every 3 weeks. Nivolumab and pembrolizumab now have a sub-Q formulation as well, and the data, you know, suggests that the efficacy is at least as good. I've looked at the data myself. It could be even better because you have like a depot effect. So there are options now, and I think most people choose the options based on the chemotherapy that you're getting. So, for example, if you're on maintenance Xeloda, maybe, you know, nivolumab every 2 weeks doesn't make that much sense, and a three-week schedule could make more sense. And then this is just a reminder that, you know, we think of immunotherapy as a very effective treatment. It does have some modest toxicity, and it's idiosyncratic, meaning that, you know, it's not like it's a cumulative dose effect. You know, some patients may get toxicity at 2 or 3 months, some don't. It's a rare event, but enough people are on it that it happens. I mean, you know, just the other day I had a patient with adrenal insufficiency, and now she has to wear a band on her arm for the rest of her life to say that she's adrenally insufficient. So if she, you know, goes to the ED in a car crash, the doctor knows to give her stress dose steroids, for example. So these are, you know, important things that people, you know, sometimes forget. HER2 positive disease, the KEYNOTE-811 defines our practice now. This is chemotherapy plus trastuzumab plus pembrolizumab, and that gives you a significant survival benefit, median survival of about 20 months. At 4 years now, 25% survival. Really, really quite impressive. TDXD, trastuzumab deruxtecan, this is an antibody drug conjugate, and the key thing here is that it's the antibody, but the drug conjugate, that's those small circles that are on the antibody. These are cytotoxic. It's the deruxtecan. It's a cytotoxic that's actually being delivered with the antibody. So it's almost like a Trojan horse. The antibody delivers the drug to the cell that's expressing it. Then it gets internalized, and then the cytotoxic agent, deruxtecan in this case, gets released inside the cell and does its damage. It's really quite effective. They're examining now trastuzumab deruxtecan with immunotherapy and chemotherapy in the first-line treatment setting. And these are waterfall plots of responses. And you can see that it's very, very rare to see such a high response rate in HER2-positive patients. So the Destiny Phase 3 gastric O4 study is looking at, in the second line setting, looked at T-DXd versus ram-paclitaxel, and it was positive. So now for the first time we have level one evidence that if you're HER2 positive in the first line setting, you're better off getting T-DXd in the second line setting instead of paclitaxel and ramucirumab. So that's a change also. And then there are two large studies that are underway looking at bringing T-DXd into the first line setting. The figure on the left is a new kind of molecule. It's called a bispecific. It's a PD-1 and anti-TIGIT monoclonal antibody that's combined. And so you can see the green boxes are binding to PD-1, and the blue boxes are binding to TIGIT. And this bispecific will inhibit both pathways. TIGIT is another checkpoint blockade pathway, so you're doing like a dual checkpoint blockade. And the Artemide study is a three-arm study looking at rivaglostomig plus T-DXd and plus or minus pembrolizumab in this setting. Or, I'm sorry, durvalumab here. And then the Destiny-Gastric05 study is very straightforward, T-DXd, 5-FU platinum, and pembro phase 3 study here. And then zanidatamab, you'll hear about this shortly. This is another kind of antibody that's actually, it's like a bispecific, but it's blocking two different parts of HER2. And it's a very effective drug, and this is the HERIZON study. This drug got approved in biliary tract cancers, so it's active. And we're going to hopefully hear in the next 6 or 9 months about its activity in a randomized study in gastroesophageal junction cancer. This is the phase 2 data that shows really nice response rates and really nicely tolerated drug. And this is the survival, and you know we're seeing as good survival as T-DXd. So these next generation HER2 targeting agents, T-DXd, zanidatamab, they're really exciting, and they really amplified the benefit that we get. The key thing with zanidatamab is that you get a lot of diarrhea. So when you combine zanidatamab with chemotherapy, particularly Xeloda, you might have dose-limiting toxicity. That's what we'll have to look out for. And then in the last, I'm a little bit over time, but in the last 2 minutes, I'm going to talk about Claudin 18.2. So Claudin 18.2 is a protein that's normally part of the epithelium of the stomach wall. If you think of it, think of the epithelium as like a picket fence. And the facets of the fence is where Claudin 18.2 is. And normally, they're in the facets, it's hidden. But as the fence breaks down, you can release the proteins that are in this facet, and it can be used as a target. And that's basically what's happening here. So Spotlight and Glow are two studies that looked at zolbetuximab, and they had very similar outcomes. Zolbetuximab has an improvement in PFS of hazard ratio 0.71, overall survival hazard ratio 0.77, highly significant, and zolbetuximab is now approved. And I'm glad that you had your first patient recently. It's a tough drug in the sense that it can cause nausea, vomiting right when you're getting the drug. After the first 2 or 3 doses, people adjust to it, and if you can get them past the first month of treatment, it's really worth your while. And the key thing here I showed at the very beginning is that there are many patients who are Claudin positive and PD-L1 negative. So think about a target in those population. And you can see across all the different risk factors, it really did seem to work. And this is an active area. So, you know, trastuzumab was approved in 1998. It got approved in 2010 for gastroesophageal junction cancer. T-DXd got approved about 13 years later. Claudin 18.2 zolbetuximab got approved last fall. 1 year later, look at this list of drugs. All these drugs are targeting Claudin 18.2. The pace of drug development and drug discovery is just amazing. So that means that you know we'll have jobs for a while. And then FGFR2. So I'm just going to quickly go through this. Bemarituzumab is an FGFR2 inhibitor. The FIGHT study looked at this in a phase 2 study. It looked very encouraging. However, the Fortitude 101 study was in fact negative for overall survival. And there was just a press release actually just 2 days ago. Fortitude 102 was also negative. So this although this is an important target, but bemarituzumab is probably not going to move forward, and there'll be other drugs that are moving forward. So I think with that, I wanted to highlight biomarkers. People should get tested right away because it changes how you manage patients. If you're PD-L1 positive only, you would think about adding a checkpoint inhibitor. If you're Claudin positive only, you'd think about adding zolbetuximab. If you're HER2 positive and PD-L1 positive, you're doing trastuzumab and pembrolizumab. And TIGIT and FGFR2 are new immunotherapies. And I think that's where we are.
You did great. That was a lot of data to get through. So I really appreciate it, Dr. Shah. We're going to jump into a case from one of our physicians, Dr. Mulhern.
Perfect.
The next cases presented by our Aon members are of gastroesophageal cancer, and we begin with a patient from Dr. Mulhern's practice that focuses in on one of the most interesting and fast-moving areas of GI oncology, the management of localized MSI-high disease. 51-year-old man.
So dysphagia, you have gastric pain, nausea, 20-pound weight loss. You had an EGD showing this distal esophageal mass that showed an adenocarcinoma. Did not have metastatic disease, but he had two suspicious paraesophageal nodes, so stage as T3N1, M0, HER2 is IC1+. MMR was performed, he's 51, and unexpectedly it was DMMR, and then NGS showed MSI high. So what do we do in this particular person? I mean, I think typically what you say is, well, this person should get FLOT. Would you give immunotherapy with it? Would you only do immunotherapy like what we're doing in rectal cancer now, for example, and kind of see how they do, answer that. So this particular person, insurance denied the addition of immunotherapy. So we actually just, we did FLOT.
What's the current status of the patient?
So did not have a PCR, but is doing adjuvant FLOT, but is struggling. I mean, FLOT is, as you know, is not easy. And we've had to have some dose reductions in order to get through. So I think we'll make it through, but it's not easy.
How could an insurance deny an IO in somebody with MSI-high disease?
So they're saying because it's not, I mean, the person, so he didn't have metastatic disease. That's the thing. And so if it's metastatic, I think that's one thing. So I've actually had difficulties with that for rectal cancer too, like stage 2, stage 3.
Right.
And those we've been able to appeal.
Wow.
This one, it's got really bad insurance. So,
wow. But upsetting.
So yeah, I would have liked to have said, let's just keep me a Pembro or Nevo and let's see what happens.
Yeah.
And just forget everything else. But
wow.
Like in rectal cancer.
Terrible, terrible.
So yeah, I mean, MSI high disease varies. In endometrial cancer, you don't have quite the bang that you get in the rectal status. And so where is that going to fall out for GE junction tumors? It brings up a good point about Matterhorn data, which is still pending, but... So let's say you have a de novo GE junction cancer patient show up. I mean, we have, I think some of it depends on where the disease. Do you have significantly proximal nodal disease? Is it really all the GE junction? If you think about the traditional chemoradiation as neoadjuvant therapy versus perioperative FLOT.
Yeah, right.
So can you kind of walk us through a scenario of how you might think through your choice of regimens for unselected patients and if they really had a meaningful biomarker in that space?
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot to unpack there. So there was a trial comparing FLOT versus Taxol, Carbo, and radiation for esophageal cancer called the ESOPEC study. And it was actually done in Germany where they developed FLOT. So I think that there was some, they didn't actually deliver the Taxol Carbo radiation very well. I mean, frankly, what happened is that the amount of dose reductions in the Taxol Carbo radiation arm was more than in the FLOT arm. And, FLOT is not so easy to give. That being said, for adenocarcinoma, we really think that chemotherapy is much more important than chemoradiation. So for esophageal adenocarcinoma, GE junction adenocarcinoma, we're, moving toward FLOT if you can get it, meaning if you can tolerate it. If you're not able to tolerate FLOT, then Taxol, Carbo, and radiation is perfectly reasonable and appropriate. It's still level 1 data. Now Matterhorn, it was presented at ASCO. It had an improvement in event-free survival. At ESMO just 2 weeks ago, the overall survival data did hit positivity. So now the NCCN guidelines do approve durvalumab plus FLOT for PD-L1 positive patients. So for esophageal adenocarcinoma, G junction adenocarcinoma, the correct answer is going to be FLOT plus durvalumab. In MSI high disease, it's a real challenge. There was one trial called the Neopaginia trial that looked at ipi/nivo by itself, and the path CR rate was about 60%. So that is a phase 2 study. Most insurance companies aren't covering it, even if you send them that data. So, frankly, what I've done in my practice is that, it's not, for a lot of patients for G junction cancer, esophageal cancer, the resectability is borderline. I mean, you have to have a good surgeon. You have to, this patient had two lymph nodes. It's not so clear. So for me, what I've done is I've basically said that these are, borderline resectable. I want to give systemic therapy. And from that standpoint, you can get approval of chemotherapy plus immunotherapy, and you can drop the chemo pretty quickly. I think that the guidelines will be updated quickly, though. I think that for localized disease, your options are really going to be surgery, localized DMMR disease. The options will be surgery or immunotherapy followed by surgery. And we have to kind of update the guidelines and educate insurances to do the right thing.
So quick question regarding just the procedure. You see the patient. It's always a sense of urgency. They've got near obstruction. You want to maintain nutritional status. Do you always get, at the time of infusiport placement, diagnostic laparoscopy to evaluate for peritoneal disease? Is that the de facto standard? Where does that CT, if that's negative, does that get you there? Do you want to know that up front?
Right. So unfortunately, a PET CT does identify occult disease, but not in the peritoneum. So it doesn't preclude the need of doing a laparoscopy. If your disease is above the diaphragm, so type 1G junction or esophageal adenocarcinoma, you probably don't need to do a laparoscopy. If your disease is below the diaphragm, even a portion of it, and it's locally advanced, especially someone that is nearly obstructing, almost certainly a laparoscopy will be needed. And a third of the time, you'll find occult peritoneal disease. So we sometimes you have to kind of twist the surgeon's arm, but you should do a laparoscopy. It doesn't have to be, you could start chemo, do a dose of chemo, and then do the lap. It doesn't matter that much. At least get the data early up, as opposed to waiting, giving all this toxicity, waiting 3 months, and then doing surgery, and then finding out there was peritoneal disease from the beginning.
Right. And let's say that patient is, HER2-3+, proficient mismatch repair, PD-L1 CPS is 5 to 10. So where's the role of HER2 therapy in this sort of perioperative?
Yeah. So there are phase 2 data that do show activity, but no phase 3 data. So for localized disease, I think if you're PD-L1 positive, the answer is FLOT plus durvalumab. If you're HER2 positive, it's still FLOT plus if you're PD-L1 positive and HER2 positive, you're still getting durvalumab. You're not targeting HER2 yet. If you're Claudin positive, you're not targeting Claudin in the localized setting. If you're DMMR, you're trying to do immunotherapy plus minus chemotherapy, or you're trying to get to surgery if possible.
Perfect. So PD-L1 negative would just be FLOT. You would not include the DURVA.
Right.
Okay.
I should say that for PD-L1 negative, they did look at that arm in the Matterhorn study, and it was underpowered. Only 10% of the patients were PD-L1 negative, less than one. The hazard ratio was 0.78, which is similar to the overall hazard ratio. So there are some people that believe that if you're PD-L1 negative, you should still get durvalumab because the toxicity is minimal. The potential benefit might be there. I'm on the other camp, primarily because We have lots of data in gastroesophageal junction cancers across thousands of patients that really you do need to be positive to have benefit in the first-line metastatic setting, in the HER2-positive setting. So this would be unusual to that only this localized setting, PD-L1 negative, could be okay. So that's why I still reserve it for the positives. And the NCCN guidelines currently agree with me.
Do you have any visceral uneasiness about not including a trastuzumab up front, given you know our experience with breast cancer and trying to get to path CR and the impact it has?
Well, I would have, except that there was a study called RTOG 1010 that looked at HER2-positive esophageal cancer, adenocarcinoma, and that it was chemoradiation plus or minus trastuzumab, and there was no benefit with trastuzumab. So unlike breast cancer... Yeah, so that gets to a little bit of the biology. In breast cancer, HER2 is a clonal disease. If one cell is HER2 positive, they all are. In gastroesophageal cancer, HER2 is subclonal, meaning that if one cell is positive, you could have other clones that are negative. And that's why lapatinib isn't as effective. That's why pertuzumab is not effective, or TDM1 is not effective in gastroesophageal junction cancer. The other drugs are effective. HER2 is a good drug, but they're not the same.
Perfect. Okay, we're going to move with the case now. Dr. Warsh.
The next case, presented by Dr. Warsh, is a 68-year-old woman presenting with metastatic HER2-positive esophageal adenocarcinoma with a PD-L1 CPS score of 1. She was treated with FOLFOX, trastuzumab, and pembrolizumab.
My plan was to start her on maintenance doublet of trastuzumab along with the pembrolizumab. However, towards the end of her chemo course, she was admitted for seemed like a viral pneumonia. We repeated the echo. The EF decreased from 60 to 45%. So at that point, we held the trastuzumab given the drop in EF. Then the hope is that she'll have recovery and we'll get back on the trastuzumab. I'm just curious what your thought is. And then as far as second-line therapy, would you consider, you know, down the road more of the standard, you know, paclitaxel along with ramucirumab, FOLFIRI ramucirumab, or would you do TDXD given that she has this HER2 positivity? And it'll be a little easier to tolerate than, you know, cytotoxic chemotherapy. So I'm just curious what your guys' go-to second-line treatment is in HER2 positive esophageal cancer. And then another question I had is, would there be a role to, you know, repeat the biopsy, confirm she still has this positive ERBB2 before doing second-line HER2 therapy?
Okay. Thoughts about re-biopsy and second-line therapy? When do you break out the TDXD here?
Yeah, so great question, great case. So for maintenance, I commonly drop the chemotherapy and continue trastuzumab and pembrolizumab in the first-line setting. At the time of progression is when you would repeat the biopsy. We just said that HER2 is subclonal. So in about 30% of patients, after progression on trastuzumab, you're going to lose the HER2 expression, and in which case then TDXD won't be as effective. So you should re-biopsy. And then if you're still positive, we just got the gastric 05 data that compared TDXD to paclitaxel and RAM, TDXD was better. So you should do TDXD in the second line setting if you remain HER2 positive.
Perfect. We talked a little bit about the toxicities associated with TDXD. Nausea was a little underappreciated when the drug first came out. I think most oncologists, because of their experience in the breast space, you know, understand the need for a little more potent antiemetics. We're going to move to the next case with Dr. Mulhern again.
The next case, presented by Dr. Mulhern, is a 73-year-old woman who presented with fatigue, anorexia, 25-pound weight loss, nausea, left upper quadrant pain, and melena with a hemoglobin of 6. EGD demonstrated a large mass in the gastric cardia, which was poorly differentiated adenocarcinoma, HER2 IHC3+, PD-L1 negative, less than 1%, and the claudin 18.2 was negative. PET-CT demonstrated pulmonary and bony metastases, and the ECOG performance status was 1 after transfusion.
Would you ever consider bypassing conventional cytotoxic chemotherapy and trastuzumab and going right to TDXD? Under what circumstances would you consider doing that?
Any questions about TDXD and gastroesophageal?
Probably the bigger issue here for GI is just the nausea part. You know, really is more highly emetogenic. So again, we get ever, you know, we will even use olanzapine, but that tends to be the biggest issue, you know, for people. I mean, most people don't get ILD. You know, we do scans very frequently, and you know, if you catch it early, right, then you know, a fair number of those patients, if they're asymptomatic, potentially treat with steroids and potentially rechallenge.
Any questions about other anti-HER2 strategies in gastroesophageal cancer?
We have this recent approval of zanidatamab in biliary tract carcinoma, but we also have TDXD. Mechanistically, what's the difference there? What is the toxicity profile? Is there advantage to being an ADC versus the bispecific mechanism? You don't have as much nausea, you don't have the ILD, but is there a mechanistic reason for favoring one over the other?
Any questions about the toxicity of TDXD?
They have protocols in place to monitor for ILD. These are like 6-week, you know, scans. There is no way in the community setting insurance is going to allow that. So I'd like to know how, outside of a clinical trial, he's managing the scan requirements for monitoring ILD. And are there any recommendations with regards to monitoring ILD? Do all patients require this monitoring, or do we go clinically first, look at the saturations and symptoms, and then only do the scans as needed?
Okay, a couple of good questions there. So let's just start with the ILD piece. You know, it was a big concern when the drug first came out. How do you screen for ILD in your patients on TDXD? Do you do the Q6 to 8-week CT scans? Do you gauge based on symptoms? Yeah. You know, if they have like symptoms, they become grade 2, and then risk of discontinuation of therapy. So
right. No, terrific questions, and really, really, really practical. So, I think that Dr. Babu is right. Like, we're not getting scans approved, even at academic centers every 6 weeks. I think it's actually hard to do them even every 8 to 9 weeks. I think that, so my patients on TDXD, I get scans as best I can every 8 weeks, every two cycles essentially, or 9 weeks, but it's every 3 weeks schedule, so every 9 weeks I get a scan. And certainly I have a low threshold for symptoms. And so, you know, the unique thing about ILD is that it could be anything. It could be a cough. It could be a little bit more short of breath, walking up a few steps. Like, any subtle symptom have a low threshold to get a scan, because that scan will get approved, a new symptom. But otherwise, get your scans every 9 weeks. I wouldn't do every 12 weeks and you know, stay on top of it. I mean, Dr. Mulhern's right. It's true that it doesn't happen that often, but when it happens, you can, you know, somebody can get really sick, spend some time in the ICU and things like that. So you really need to jump on it. The nausea is significant for TDXD as well. I think one thing people don't appreciate is that the approved dose for gastroesophageal junction is higher. It's 6.4 mg per kg. In breast cancer, we're using a lower dose. And I'll be honest, in my practice, I don't use the 6 milligram dose. I use the lower dose. So, and I think it's as effective. So,
all right, that was a question. Because in the breast space, we talked about this earlier, like, we've learned to dose adjust that, you know, no
exactly.
Loss in efficacy, much more tolerability. When you look at frontline TDXD data that came out with DB09, like, how do we?
Right.
So,
no, I'm with you there. And then the last question, which was a great question, was any difference between zanidatamab and TDXD? And we talked a little bit about it earlier. So remember, TDXD is an antibody drug conjugate. It's like a Trojan horse. It delivers a payload to the cell that expresses HER2. The cell internalizes it, and then the payload gets released. So it's truly like a Trojan horse. And so there are key things that people, you know, that antibody drug conjugates, like, you have to think about. One is, what's the target? So here the target is HER2. The other is the linker. So TDXD uniquely has a cleavable linker. So the reason why that's important is because the cytotoxic drug can be released inside the cell that's HER2 positive, but it can also be released in the microenvironment where there are other cells that are not HER2 positive, but it's their gastric cancers are, you know, the cells are next to each other. And then the third thing is the payload itself. So deruxtecan is a camptothecin. It's like irinotecan. These are effective in GI cancers. Emtanzine, which is TDM1, is not effective in gastroesophageal junction cancers. That's why TDM1 was probably not positive in the study that we ran. So those are the three things for ADCs. For bispecifics, it's what's the other target? So for zanidatamab, it's HER2 and HER4. It's HER2, but it's two different parts of HER2. Just like trastuzumab and pertuzumab bind to two different parts of HER2, same with zanidatamab. It's effective. The toxicity is a little bit different. You have diarrhea, not ILD, not so much nausea. And so because of that toxicity, maybe you can't combine it with chemotherapy that well. In biliary tract cancer, it's given by itself. In the HERIZON study, it's with chemotherapy. We'll have to see the data for that.
And you wouldn't anticipate a bystander effect from zanidatamab as opposed
right.
to T-DXd.
Exactly.
Perfect. All right, we're going to move into another case with Dr. Lamar.
The next case is presented by Dr. Lamar.
I have a 73-year-old lady, and she developed abdominal pain, weight loss, and just dyspepsia. So she had a CT scan, and the CT scan showed diffuse thickening of the stomach. It showed periaortic lymph nodes. And so she had an EGD that showed a large mass at the GE junction, and she had gastric thickening. So she had a biopsy that showed adenocarcinoma. Her PDL, like CPS score, was like 15. She was HER2 2 plus, but FISH negative. And so we started her on FOLFOX and nivolumab, but we ordered Claudin like 18.2 testing, and the test was lost. And after she started therapy, it actually returned positive. What we ultimately ended up doing was doing a PET scan. She had a very nice response, so we continued her on therapy. And we've opted to do zolbetuximab in the second line setting if it comes up. But I am curious if, one, what the investigators are doing, how are they making sure that this test is ordered early on? Because I actually thought that this was a part of the NGS testing that I ordered, and I was told that it was, but I found out later on that it was not. And so how are you making sure that this testing is ordered, and how would you have treated this patient?
So brings up a really great question
yeah.
for those patients who are Claudin 18 positive, but also PD-L1 positive. You have two frontline options. What factors into your decision? I know we have some data that looks like perhaps PFS may be better with the zolbetuximab in that space, but sort of leave it to you to help guide us
yeah.
there. And does the location of the tumor matter in any, you know, if it's a Seward 1, 2 versus upper esophagus or more gastric, does that impact into the probability of Claudin 18 utilization versus?
Yeah, these are great questions. So, you know, this is a data-free zone, so I could say whatever I want. But I think it's the trials are ongoing now. So we don't have data. If you're both Claudin positive and PD-L1 positive, which one to choose? They're both approved in the first line setting. And I think it might be hard to get insurance approval to use either one in the second line setting. So you kind of have to make a decision up front. There is more toxicity with zolbetuximab with the first and second treatment. And, you know, from a practical standpoint, if you have a patient that's a little bit tenuous, that, you know, they're not sure about chemotherapy, if you give them too much toxicity, you might lose them. You know, that's like a no-brainer that you're going to maybe avoid the zolbetuximab. Alternatively, we know that immunotherapy works better with a higher PD-L1 scores. So if you're CPS or TAP 5 or 10, then maybe even if you're claudin positive, you might be leaning toward immunotherapy because the PD-L1 score is high. There are lots of data that says that the higher the score, the bigger the magnitude of benefit. So conversely, if your PD-L1 is low, less than 1 or even 1 or 2, like very barely positive, then zolbetuximab might have some activity. Now, kind of in the weeds here, there is a suggestion that maybe zolbetuximab might have some more activity in peritoneal metastases. But I think that that's kind of, it's claudin is more expressed in diffuse gastric cancer. Diffuse gastric cancer tends to spread to the peritoneum a little more, so it might be more along those lines. The studies are ongoing now in the first-line setting with claudin positivity and giving a PD-1 inhibitor or not and seeing which one's better. So we'll get those data in the next few years. But right now, in terms of making a decision, I think you have to read the patient. I mean, it's like you have 10 different high blood pressure medicines and you have to choose. So same thing. You have to choose based on the profile of the patient in front of you. But I think in the community, probably most people are using a checkpoint inhibitor because, it's less toxic, it takes less chair time, that kind of thing.
So specifically with the administration of zolbetuximab, you guys put them in a special room, you're giving them olanzapine, you're giving them the whole thing, like because they're going to throw up as this drug interacts with those. I thought you did a wonderful job with the cartoons elucidating the mechanism of action there, right? Yeah. And so as those tight junctions get exposed, they all have significant nausea and emesis. And any special tips to help manage that?
Yeah, for sure. So I mentioned earlier that if you're able to get through the first two or three doses of zolbetuximab, the toxicity is much better tolerated. So have patience. If someone on their first dose is getting nausea, vomiting, it's okay to pause the infusion, give them some antiemetic, some olanzapine, some Ativan, and then resume after 30 minutes at a lower rate and get them through it. And actually, the first dose is 800 milligrams per kilogram. It's a loading dose. And it typically could be given over 4 to 6 hours. And what that means is that if you're giving FOLFOX after that, it's a long day for the patient. So you might need to plan for that. So those are things just to get them through. The second dose is less. It's a lower dose, and it's generally better tolerated. And the third dose, even better. So just, you got to prepare. If you're prepared, prepare your chemotherapy unit, prepare the patient, prepare your nurse to say, it's going to be a long day, we get through it, and you're going to thank me in a month.
So let's say in the community we started with FOLFOX plus an immune checkpoint inhibitor. They progressed. I mean, is it reasonable to seek approval for a claudin 18.2 positive patient in the second line setting? And have you had success in that?
Yeah, so there's some data for that. We did do it's called the Alestro trial. We did do a trial of zolbetuximab in the second and third line and later, and there was limited activity by itself. So I think for zolbetuximab to be effective, you probably have to give it with chemotherapy. At this point, I wouldn't use it in the second line setting after progression on a checkpoint inhibitor in the first line setting. I'd go to Taxol and Cyramza in the second line setting. In gastroesophageal junction cancers, we have irinotecan, we have Taxol, Cyramza, we have Lonsurf, and most patients aren't getting through all the drugs. So you don't need to go to zolbetuximab necessarily. You have other options, second line and third line, to get through.
Perfect. Another case with Dr. Iannucci.
The next case is presented by Dr. Iannucci, a 45-year-old man with stage 4 distal esophageal adenocarcinoma that's claudin 18.2 positive with a PD-L1 level of 10% and is HER2 negative. The patient is currently receiving FOLFOX plus zolbetuximab.
His treatment course was, in retrospect, very characteristic of the side effects of zolbetuximab. He had very significant side effects of nausea, vomiting, specifically with the first cycle, requiring hospitalizations almost after every cycle of FOLFOX zolbetuximab, despite antiemetics and hydration and preemptive therapy. So he struggled through this course. He continues to struggle. He continues to have frequent admissions. He currently is actually in the hospital right now. At best, I think we could say that he has stable disease on this regimen. So my questions with this case would be, what kind of results have you seen in your patients on this new drug?
Have you used zolbetuximab before?
Nope, this is my first patient on it.
Did you try slowing the infusion down?
We did, yes.
Any questions for the faculty?
Would you have gone with a PD-L1 based regimen prior to zolbetuximab? In retrospect, I'm not sure that I would use this up front. I was reading back about some of the progression-free survival data, and it's pretty modest compared to just a plain FOLFOX backbone.
Okay, a wonderful case, sort of highlighting the dilemma that we were discussing, right? Do you have buyer's remorse or do you have FOMO when you try to choose? And then, and then you give something that's really toxic or can be in certain situations, and how do you manage that? So just wanted to provide some granular context to the discussion we had before, but feel free to elaborate, because I think, you know, if that's your first experience with this drug,
it's going
to
be tough.
Right.
No, it's a good... It's a really illustrative case. So the only thing I would say is that it does have activity. I've seen patients benefit from it. So I guess I would say don't give up on it. I mean, you know, not only the patient with the nausea vomiting, but also the provider. Like, you know, try it again. I led one of the trials, so that's a disclosure. So I might be biased, but that being said, I even outside of a trial, I have seen some patients benefit from it. One of the benefits is that it doesn't seem to have the, you know, adrenal insufficiency, thyroid issues, rash, the things that you can see with the checkpoint inhibitor. So it's not all negative. That being said, you have to be prepared. And unlike a checkpoint inhibitor, it doesn't increase the response rate to FOLFOX. The response ratio is the same. It's just that the duration of response in some patients might be better. It's a good target. We need to manage it better. And hopefully with time we will.
I think you highlighted throughout your talk a couple of points that were really interesting. I mean, the need to test, right? It's absolutely mandatory to identify these patients now that we have actionable targets. When you do your NGS testing in practice, you know, some of these are IHCs, some are NGS, some are, and that varies across disease states. How do you incorporate that? Does everyone hit the door? Are you doing liquid plus solid paraffin embedded tissue when they come in?
Yeah, that's a great question. And somebody else had mentioned it earlier. So it is really hard, and it's important to stay on top of it. We're fortunate because we have what we call reflexive testing, where I talked to the pathologist and I said, look, anybody with a gastroesophageal adenocarcinoma, just go ahead and do MMR, PD-L1, HER2, and Claudin. And if you do it up front, then you have it. And those are all I'd see. You can do MMR by ctDNA. You can do NGS testing, but if you do IHC, that's like 8 slides. You can get the key markers for now. That doesn't mean that you don't need the others, like for NTRK and for other things like that, but those are more rare. The ones that will affect your day-to-day decision making, it's just those 4. MMR, it's IHC, PD-L1, HER2, and Claudin. If you're HER2 borderline, then you might need to do FISH, like standard. And I think it's hard. If you're not having it done reflexively, also there might be an issue with how much tissue is available, and then is it worth another biopsy and things like that. So these are challenges. I think the only way to get through it is to educate our pathologists, educate our gastroenterologists, make sure you get good biopsies, multiple cores. There's no reason to be stingy there. Just the more tissue, the better.
Right. And have you seen long-term durable responses with those drugs you mentioned that we frequently don't get to? They may not be quite as sexy as the targeted therapy, but the ramucirumabs of the world.
Yeah. So, it's a tough disease. I mean, median survival for gastric and esophageal junction is still around a year, maybe 14 months, something like that. If you're HER2 positive, you know, it's a different category. If you're MSI high, it's a different category. But the majority of patients are going to be just regular, you know, non-HER2 positive, non-MMR deficient. And, you know, I think there are some caveats. So not caveats, like tricks of the trade. So, for example, the pace of the disease is fast. You could have someone doing okay, and then they start having a little bit of nausea. They're on FOLFOX, you know, Pembro, whatever, and they have a little bit of nausea, and they had a scan 3 weeks ago. I wouldn't wait another 2 months to get a scan. Do the scan early. They may have early progression, and switch them. You know, that's the reason why people don't get to third line, fourth line therapy is because they progress through and they lose their performance status very quickly. It's not like breast cancer. It's not like prostate cancer. It's not like colon cancer where the pace of the disease is slower. It's like pancreas, it's esophagus, gastric. So get your scans quickly, move on to the next treatment. You know, the more drugs you use, the more likely you'll have those long-term survival experiences.
Thank you for those insights. Really appreciate it. And thank you for being here, Dr. Shah, with the research and practice team.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you. I have 20 more slides if you want to
start. That's right. There is a post-meeting survey that's available, so we would ask that you guys fill that out. It should be on the iPads there. But thank you guys for attending, and hope you found this enlightening.
Great. Thank you.